9. 6:37 p.m., November 13, 2018. Marcy Lansing Apartments, Chicago, Illinois. Matilda and Todd were leaving a patient's room on the 7th floor when an older lady with braided hair pulled Matilda aside.
"Can I talk to you, please?"
The woman's eyes darted. She clearly had a secret. "Of course." As Matilda followed the woman down the hall toward the stairs, she turned and waved back to Todd. "I'll meet you down at the car in just a few minutes," she told him. He looked confused. "It's fine," Matilda assured Todd. The woman brought Matilda into her neat apartment at the end of the hall beside the elevator. It was homey, with a couch covered in plastic, dozens of framed photos of family, and several oil paintings of Jesus. There were potted plants in every corner, mostly wandering Jews and ferns.
"It's about Janice's daughter," the woman said. "Something's wrong with her."
"Okay.
My neighbor, Janice. Her girl, Ashanique. She just ain't right lately.
Can I ask your name?" The woman glanced back over her shoulder at the door to her apartment. It was shut, though she was still clearly nervous, obviously trying to tell Matilda something she shouldn't be.
"I'm Carol. But that ain't important. It's Ashanique. You need to just talk to her. See if she's all right. Last few days, she seems off. Different."
"How old is Ashanique?"
11. Her mama has me watch her after school when she's at work. She's very protective, Janice. Ashanique's her only child, and even though she's tough with the girl, she'd do anything for her. That's what's got me concerned, you know? Ashanique ain't acting herself, and when I brought it up to Janice, shit, well, she basically told me to just mind my own business. But I know Ashanique. I know something's wrong."
"Is Ashanique home now?"
"She's upstairs," Carol said. "I can bring you up there."
As they made their way up the stairs, Carol told Matilda about the family.
"Never seen the father, but Janice is a good mother. Don't get me wrong. This place, it takes discipline to raise a child right. You got to have your hand on them, if you know what I mean. Temptation to do the wrong thing every day. A lot of bad people. A lot of desperate ones, too. Lord."
Matilda followed Carol onto the 9th floor, where they stopped at a door marked 915. Carol said,
"She ain't gonna want to talk to you. Not at first."
"I understand.
I wouldn't bring you up here if I didn't think it was the best thing for her."
Carol pulled a key from her purse and unlocked the door. Stepping inside, she called for Ashanique. The apartment was stripped down to the bare essentials. Secondhand furniture and a few standing lamps. A window fan spun lazily. Matilda's cell buzzed in her coat pocket. It was Todd checking in. He sent a text telling her that he didn't like the idea of her being alone in the building. He wanted to know where she was and if he should come back in. 10 minutes, she replied. "I'll be out soon." Todd sent the quizzical faced emoji, followed by 5 minutes. Carol knocked on a bedroom door at the back of the apartment. It was only when she saw the door that Matilda realized that there was no art on the walls of this apartment. No family photos, no color. The door to Ashanique's room looked as though it belonged to a different family. Its surface was a riot of drawings. Pencil, pen, finger paint, whiteout, charcoal. The little girl who lived behind it had used everything she could think of to create a complex mural of half-glimpsed shapes and strange figures. It was like viewing a car crash through a thick veil of fog.
"She'd done this just the other day," Carol said, reading the surprise on Matilda's face. "Stayed up all night to make it."
Looking closely at the drawings, Matilda could make out soldiers, hills, trees, and a horse. its blackened body merged with the ruins of a building. It was clearly drawn with a child's hand, but there was a macabre power in the simplicity of the sketches. Something akin to a middle school Guernica.
"This is why I came to you," Carol told Matilda. "She needs help. Bad."
The bedroom door opened, and Matilda stood to see Ashanique. She was struck by the girl's gaze, like looking into the eyes of a much older person. Matilda had never believed the old aphorism about the eyes being the windows to the soul. It smacked of New Age cheesiness. But with Ashanique's eyes, Matilda felt as though she were looking into the eyes of her grandfather. They were deep, wild pools of experience. Unbroken. Vivid. "Ashanique? My name is Matilda. Is it okay if we talk?"
"Ashanique's just one of me," the girl said.
10. Ashanique's room looked just like her door. Every surface crawled with crayon, pencil, and paint. Every inch of the room was ornamented by drawings of war and violence. Soldiers marched across the walls. Explosions sent spirals of black smoke into churning blue-gray clouds. There was blood, and there was fire, and there was rain. Matilda could not believe the varying styles of the artwork. From crimpled, highly detailed illustrations, she could make out the broken teeth in the mouth of a screaming soldier, to loose, abstract swaths of panicked, chaotic forms that suggested paroxysms of rage. Matilda had never seen anything quite like it.
"Want to sit down?"
Ashanique asked. The girl dragged a school chair with an attached tray from the corner and set it beside her bed. Matilda sat. Despite the mania covering the walls, the bed was neatly, almost expertly made. Perfect corners. The kind you could bounce a quarter off of. On one of the pillows was a drawing of a building, like a military base, ensconced in a snowy pine forest. Matilda smiled at Ashanique. "My name is Matilda Deacon. I'm a professor and social worker."
"I've seen you here before," Ashanique said.
"Is your mother around?"
"No."
"And who watches over you when she's gone?"
"I'm old enough to take care of myself, but if she has to, Mrs. Carol looks after me."
Law required Matilda to talk to the parent, with the exception of an emergency situation. If she were to encounter a child in immediate danger, she could intervene. Clearly, Ashanique didn't appear to be in any physical distress. But Matilda was desperate to understand what was going on. It wasn't such a leap in her mind to assume that the girl's psychological condition was deteriorating. It was bending the rules, but she technically could classify it as an emergency.
"Okay," Matilda continued. "That's good. My work involves talking to children. Children who might be having troubles, things that they worry about. Things that keep them awake at night. Is there anything worrying you, Ashanique? Mrs. Carol says she's concerned you might not be feeling well."
Matilda glanced over to where Carol had been standing, but she was no longer in the room.
"I'm feeling fine," Ashanique said. "At first I thought I might be sick. I was scared when it started. But now I think I understand what's happening."
Matilda leaned forward. "What is happening?"
"The people inside me. They aren't silent anymore."
"What people, Ashanique?" "There are so many," the girl chuckled.
"George was first. I didn't know why, but I think now it's because he died in shock. He didn't know what hit him. That made a big difference. The others? They've been coming back slower. At first, they're just these echoes, but the more they show me, the stronger they get."
"Have you told your mother about these voices?"
Ashanique nodded. "She tells me not to worry about them."
"But are you worried?"
"No. Not anymore. Do you mind if I make some notes? Arsenique shrugged, as Matilda reached into her purse and pulled out a notepad and pen. She scribbled a few key words. Auditory hallucinations? Endural phenomenon? To guide her thoughts later. She didn't want to admit that the case was unusual. In her experience, every past life regression case initially felt like it could be something she'd never seen before. But then, after a few minutes of directed talk, they always fell into established categories. Always. Matilda knew that mental illnesses were like snowflakes. No matter how unusual the expression of the pathology was, every illness could be categorized. Still, Arsenique's condition instantly felt unique. Not only did the girl seem preternaturally calm and collected, but she also didn't speak like an 11-year-old girl. She phrased things like an adult and used uncommon terminology. Arsenique spoke like someone very well read. It was possible, Matilda considered, that the girl had been coached. Maybe she was just a good actor. Maybe this was scripted. What do these voices tell you? Arsenique thought for a second. They're stories. Life stories. But it sounds silly saying they tell me these things. They don't tell me. They don't show me either. I just know them. Like when you wake up and open your eyes and, even though you've been dreaming about something crazy, you know you're in your room. You know the dream was just a dream. I know their stories. Matilda wrote down, dream versus story. Can you tell me George's story? Arsenique nodded. But it's sad. I understand. Arsenique was quiet for a moment before she said, why do you want to know all this? I tried to tell Mrs. Carroll. She didn't want to hear it. I tried to tell a few of the other kids who live around here. Like the boy next door. Him. The rest of them. They said I was crazy. Like I was talking like I'm sick or something. Why do you want to know about this so bad? Mrs. Carroll make it sound really terrible or something? Matilda folded her arms in her lap. Okay. Like I said, I'm a professor. Of what? Psychology. You're not a doctor. Matilda cringed at that. It was a sore point. One she battled before. No. I have a PhD in psychology. Matilda felt as though that would be saying enough, but she couldn't help herself. Even if Arsenique didn't care, she needed to prove herself, to defend her choices. I knew I wanted to go into research, so I did a dual PhD in neuropsychology and chemistry. I talk to patients because I like people, and it's something the university encourages. We enjoy getting out into the community and helping where we can. So, what do you want to know? Arsenique asked. Tell me about George. All these drawings you've done. He did them. Okay. Matilda said, correcting herself. All the drawings that George has done. I see people fighting. I see fire and horses and it looks like cities in ruins. The people are soldiers. George was never a very good illustrator. He drew small doodles for his kid sometimes, but this stuff is different. These are overwhelming. Arsenique pointed to a corner near the window. That is the Battle of La Bassée, and over there is Lens and Aumontiers. And on the ceiling is what he saw at Vilcha. That last one is significant. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's a village where George saw the gas being used the first time. Arsenique's careful French struck Matilda. The girl had either heard the names of these villages and towns before, or someone had taught her how to pronounce them. What gas? Arsenique pointed over her shoulder at a crayon triptych above the bedroom window. Soldiers could be seen, lying on the ground,
scattered like blown leaves. Their faces, though scrawled in a child's hand, were twisted into tearful howls.
Phosgene, Ashanik said matter-of-factly, typically mixed with chlorine.
And where did George read about that?
He didn't. He saw. He was one of the lucky ones to have a gas mask.
Matilda looked past Ashanik at the drawing.
People always assume it's the chlorine, Ashanik continued, but it wasn't. The chlorine was bad, all right, but phosgene was a terrible irritant to the lungs and the mucous membranes.
Most of the exposed soldiers survived the gas attack at the Third Battle of Ypres.
The ones who didn't, they suffered something awful. Ashanik's expression was one born of experience. It was the crimped, pained face of someone talking plainly about something that, under any circumstances, other than the dilution of time, would have been unbearable.
Matilda excused herself for a moment and pulled out her cell to text Todd. She sent him the room number and told him to come up immediately. Then, reaching into her purse, Matilda pulled out a small video camera. She knew she was bending every ethical rule imaginable, if not outright breaking them. But she needed proof, photographic evidence, that what she was hearing was as real as it felt. Trying to calm her excitement, Matilda told herself that there had to be a trick.
There is simply no way this girl is what she seems.
You need to break the illusion down. Make sense of it. You're being played, girl.
Is it okay if I film our interview?
Do you usually film your interviews?
Only the ones I need to revisit.
So you believe me? Ashanik asked.
I believe that you're telling me the truth.
Fine, Ashanik said. Matilda set the video camera on the tray. Leaning in to look through the viewfinder, she lined Ashanik up within the digital frame. As she did so, she noticed that the girl was smiling but still anxious. Ashanik toyed with several colorful plastic bracelets on her left wrist. One red, one green, one yellow, and another red. Matilda wondered if this was the very first time that anyone had really, truly listened to Ashanik's story.
Do you show it to other people?
Ashanik asked. Matilda shook her head.
No, just for me. It's transcribed, though.
And who does that?
Someone at the university.
Someone you trust?
Of course.
Good, Ashanik said. Because some of what I'm going to tell you is disturbing. Some of it is going to make you very uncomfortable. I just want to make sure you don't get in trouble for it.
I won't.
Matilda pressed record. A little red light flashed on the back of the video camera.
Here we go,
Matilda said, more for her own comfort than the girl's. 11. 11/13/18. Transcription number 098.19. Dr. Matilda Deacon, employee number 34-7609. The following transcription is of an interview with a female 11-year-old subject, A.W., regarding her belief that she is experiencing past life recollections. A.W. is a healthy girl, African-American, oriented to time and place. Appeared calm and willing to answer questions. Mother was not present, but A.W.'s caregiver approached me. She was quite concerned about A.W.'s behavior, suggesting it was an emergent situation.
Note, I have a consent form on file signed by A.W.'s mother, Janice Walters, for social service work in the Marcy Lansing apartment. Consent was collected by my colleague, Dr. Todd Garcia Arreyes, 11 months prior to my visit. There are no records of Dr. Garcia Arreyes ever speaking with A.W. or Janice. Regarding past lives, A.W. is stringent in her conviction that these recollections are the result of inherited memories
though she describes them as people who exist inside her. Dr. Todd Garcia Arreaz comes in around minute 3, 15 seconds. Dr. Deacon.
Can you tell me about George?
Subject, A.W. George Edwin Ellison was a British soldier in World War I. He was the last British casualty of the war. Dr. Deacon. What unit was he with? A.W. 5th Royal Irish Lancers, a private. Dr. Deacon. And when did he die? A.W. He was killed by a sniper's bullet at 10:55 a.m. on November 11, 1918. He died at 10:59 a.m. It was raining. He didn't hear the shot. He fell backward. The rain was hitting his face. Dr. Deacon. And you experienced this? A.W. Every second of it. As if it was this morning. Dr. Deacon. Does that scare you? A.W. At first it did. More from the shock. Dr. Deacon. This was a violent death. I would imagine that would be quite frightening to see, let alone experience. A.W. Yes, but you have to put it in perspective. George came from a long, long line. He knew it would continue beyond him. And that last second, he knew. Dr. Deacon. How? How did he know that? A.W. I don't know. It was in the last milliseconds. The very last images in his brain. He saw them. He saw me. Dr. Deacon. He saw you? In 1918? A.W. Yes. Dr. Deacon. You do know that some people will have trouble understanding that, right? That some people will suggest that this is all information you learned or were taught? That maybe this stuff just got mixed up in your head. Sometimes we conflate dreams with reality. There have been studies, research studies, showing that nearly 50% of the memories we have are inaccurate. They're either distortions or they're made up. A.W. That's because science hasn't caught up with this yet. It's like that saying about the elephant and the blind man. Dr. Deacon. That they can only describe one part of the animal. A trunk. Big ears. A tail. A.W. And it sounds like a fairy tale creature when you only talk about parts of it. But when you see it as a whole, you understand it's reasonable. Dr. Deacon. And you can see these memories the same way? A.W. Yes. Pause. But it's not just seeing. I feel it. I know it. Anyone can know the facts about George. Stuff that was in the papers. He was a minor. Had a wife and a child. I can tell you everything about George. But it's not so much me telling you the facts. It's the feelings. And he felt so much. Dr. Deacon. What did he feel? A.W. George looked at the world different from the way you and I do. He sometimes would stop dead in his tracks. They'd be marching, his regiment, and he'd stop and just stare up at the sky. All the other guys bumping into him, they'd think he was crazy. He wasn't. He was looking at the clouds, the way the light bounced off them, the way they moved and shifted shape. That captivated him, but it was more than just the visual. It was the way it felt, staring up into the sky, seeing the clouds. He was in awe of it. The feeling he had was astonishment. Dr. Deacon. At clouds? A.W. Sounds silly, I know. Dr. Deacon.
It doesn't, no. I didn't mean... Clouds can be striking. The sky can be inspiring. Some people can find beauty in the smaller details. The things most of us either ignore completely or take for granted. A.W. That was George. He appreciated the little things. 3:12. Dr. Deacon. Do you know what cold reading is? A.W. No. Dr. Deacon. It's a skill that some people have. Mind readers, magicians, a way to tell what someone is thinking. To expect their answers and their choices, but reading their body language, their facial expressions. A door is heard opening. A.W. looks off camera.
Dr. Garcia Arreyes.
Sorry. A.W. It's okay. We were just talking. Dr. Garcia Arreyes.
Is it all right with you if I sit in?
A.W. nods. A.W. Are you going to ask me questions too? Dr. Garcia Arreyes. Not unless you want me to. Dr. Deacon. Getting back to where we were. Are you telling me these things because you think they'll impress me? A.W. Of course not. You wanted to talk to me. Dr. Deacon. Yes, I did. I'm trying to help you. A.W. I don't need help. Not any help that you can give me. I've seen the elephant doctor. I don't think that makes me crazy. Pause. I'm not doing any cold reading. I'm telling you what I know. You can look it all up online. Everything about George. But that won't convince you, will it? And you need to be convinced. Dr. Deacon. I don't think it's that cut and... A.W. George carved a smiley face on the back of his pocket watch. It was a gift from his uncle. Nothing too expensive. But that pocket watch saw George through the war. It kept him sane. He was thinking of his kid one night. There was a break in the shelling. The air stank of sulfur and the sky was lit up like it was on fire. But for the first time in days, there was a moment of silence. He carved the smiley face in the back of the pocket watch then. It wasn't like an emoji. He wasn't an artist or anything. But it was more detailed than just a circle, a curved line, and two dots. It was something to make his kid happy. A present to him. He died looking at it 3 weeks later. Dr. Deacon, what do you think all this means? Beyond having this information, beyond seeing and feeling these things, what does it mean to you? A.W. Do you believe in synchronicity, doctor? Dr. Deacon, I suppose it depends. There are competing definitions, but I do believe in meaningful coincidences. A.W. The night doctors say synchronicity is real. 7:39. Dr. Deacon gasps, and then is quiet. A.W. leans forward. Silence until 7:42. Dr. Deacon. The night doctors. Where did you hear that? A.W. I've seen them. In my memories. George didn't see them. He was dead before they came. But the other ones did. I was drawing a picture of it before you came here. Dr. Deacon. What other ones? A.W. I remember them all. All the way back. They were scared. My old selves, they were terrified. Dr. Deacon. Of the night doctors? A.W. Yes. Dr. Deacon. Are you scared of them? Does someone here or at school hurt you? Maybe someone you trusted? Maybe someone your mother knows? A.W. I should be scared of them, but I'm not. They will be looking for me. I know that now.
Dr. Deacon. Why will they be looking for you?
A.W.
Because of what happened in that place. A.W. turns around to the bed and picks up a drawing of a square black building in a forest by the ocean. There is snow around the building.
Dr. Deacon.
What happened there?
A.W.
Something terrible. I can't see the details yet.
Dr. Deacon. But you will eventually, you think?
A.W. Yes.
Dr. Deacon.
I would very much like to hear about that then.
A.W.
You're a nice person, Doctor. I know you're trying to help me. But if you do, the night doctors will find you. They find everyone.
There is a rustling sound before recording stops. 10:21. End.
12.
The hell is going on in here? Jana stormed in incensed.
Ashanik jumped up and ran between her mother and Matilda, as Matilda shoved the video camera back into her purse.
Mom, it isn't.
Ashanik stopped short when she saw the fury in her mother's eyes. She knew instinctively that Janice's rage wasn't because of Matilda's being there. It was because Ashanik had broken her mother's trust. And trust, as Janice had explained, since Ashanik was old enough to understand the word, was the glue that kept a relationship between mother and daughter strong. Without trust, well, you had nothing. Ashanik wanted to defend herself. She wanted to tell her mom that she wasn't a part of this. Matilda came in because Carol brought her. But she knew that wasn't the full story. The full story was that Ashanik wanted to talk, that she was desperate to tell someone about what was happening to her, and she wanted Janice to know that Matilda was a sweet person. A person who would listen without judgment or fear. But the words never left her mouth.
I need you to leave,
Janice told Matilda. Right the fuck now. Todd stood at the front door and held it open, as Matilda gathered her stuff and formulated apologies.
Mrs. Walters, I'm sorry. Carol asked me to talk to Ashanik because she was worried.
I don't know if you remember, but you signed a release form when my colleague and I came a few months ago.
Doesn't matter. I didn't approve this.
That's what I'm telling you.
Janice pointed to the door.
I need you out. Now.
Janice spent 2 hours stuck in traffic. Work had been hell and she was getting worse. The headache that had trailed her home blossomed during her commute. Every red light, every time the bus driver tapped his brake, the discomfort grew. What began as pinpricks behind her eyes had metastasized into a throbbing mass of white, hot pain. Janice tried to diffuse it with ibuprofen and Metrochime, exceeding the strongest dose Dr. Song had recommended, but they did little to help. Dr. Song had warned Janice that at her age, it would be only a matter of months before she'd need to begin IV treatment, and possibly a year or two before the long nap.
Fuck that, Janice had thought at the time.
Not me, not now. Truth was, Janice's condition had never affected her work. But that week, she'd only been able to cut hair 4 days. The other three she was shaking in bed. It took everything in her to not look like the complete mess she was. The most recent memory that had crept into her head was profoundly disturbing. Luckily, it was choppy, as half-formed as the mind that made it. When Janice pieced the memory together, she saw her own feet, twisted by disease, clumsily stomping through mud, thick with the scythe-like rib bones of cattle and grinning human skulls. She held a human femur, one end sharpened into a fierce point in her left hand. Its tip was bloodied. The afternoon's headache brought the memory with it, and further strained Janice's already tenuous hold on her patients. And that was before she found Matilda in her apartment. While Matilda kept trying to explain herself, all Janice could think of
was the gun in the bathroom. She knew people had killed for far less, but she couldn't do it. No matter what the memories might suggest, she wasn't a killer.
"I'm going to go, okay?"
Matilda said, backing out of Ashanik's room and heading toward the front door, where Carol stood red-faced.
"But I really need to talk to you about your daughter. Please, there is something."
"No." Janice followed Matilda through the living room. "Not going to happen, doctor."
"But there is something going on with Ashanik. Carol's not making it up or being overreactive. I think it would be really, really valuable for both you and Ashanik if you brought her by my office at the university, just to talk through some of what she's told me. I think this is very important."
"She makes things up," Janice said. "She reads a lot of books."
"I understand that."
"No, you don't.
She's telling you stories to impress you."
"And it worked, didn't it?" Ashanik likes to show off how smart she is because she's an incredibly smart girl. And the people at her school don't get her. But I get her. Don't doubt that for a second. I get her as clear as anyone else. And I'm telling you to forget it."
Matilda pulled her business card from her purse.
"I stealed." Janice ignored her and placed her hand on the doorframe.
Matilda looked back at Ashanik. The girl was embarrassed and scared. Janice could see it, and her face softened, though only slightly.
"We're good," she told her daughter. "They're leaving now. We're gonna be just fine."
Matilda handed her business card to Carol and stepped into the hall.
"Don't ever come back," Janice threatened. The door slammed shut, hard, enough to rattle the frame.
13. 7:12 p.m., November 13, 2018, I-90, Chicago, Illinois.
"Well, that was exciting. You okay?"
Todd looked over at Matilda as he eased the Volvo onto the interstate. After they'd returned to the car, Matilda spent the first few minutes in silence, scrolling through websites on her phone.
"Jesus, there was something seriously unhinged about that woman. Think she was on something?"
Matilda wasn't listening to him, despite her looking up from her phone. She gave Todd a blank stare.
"Sorry, just, it's okay. Lot to process. It's all real. All of it."
Matilda had pulled up everything she could find on the life and death of George Edwin Ellison, and everything Ashanik had said checked out. Every fact about his place of birth, his regiment, his injuries, and his family. With one exception, Matilda couldn't find any mention of a smiley face etched into the back of George's pocket watch. The pocket watch existed. It was housed in the Canadian War Museum in Ottawa, and there were even pictures of it online. But the smiley face wasn't among them. Matilda found it curious. Ashanik had made quite a deal of the engraving, hammering it hard in her retelling of George's life.
Maybe the girl just read the Wikipedia entry.
No. Matilda shook her head. She wasn't reciting. Hang on. Matilda called the War Museum. She made her way through various museum staff before being directed to the voicemail of one of the curators. She left a detailed message asking about George Edwin Ellison's pocket watch and a family legend about there being a picture on the back. She felt silly when she hung up the phone.
"Wow, you're serious," Todd said, looking over at her.
"I've never seen anyone like her."
"Come on," Todd laughed dismissively. "The girl's cute. She's got a great effect. I wouldn't be surprised to find out she was older than she looked. You know, this sort of thing happens. The girl's a great actress. The mom's coaching her, and they fool a bunch of people like you, into getting them things, hooking them up with meds and tests. I've seen it happen. Stone cold sociopathic. I'm not talking Munchausen by proxy or folie à deux."
"Janice didn't even want us there. You saw how she reacted."
Exactly. That's part of the scam.
Todd, you're talking crazy. I do think Janice is hiding something, but it's not about some scam to get drugs. That's silly.
And jaded.
No. Something real is happening with Ashanique.
Maybe high-functioning Savant syndrome or odd manifestation of ideasthesia.
Whatever it is, Janice knows what's going on with her. She just doesn't want to talk about it.
I think you're spooked, blindsided.
Will you just stop?
Matilda sank back into her seat with a sigh. She wasn't sure why she was so unnerved. Everything Ashanique had told her, all the details, like the names of the battles George had fought in, were impressive. But what Matilda couldn't get out of her head were all the things the girl only hinted at.
Okay, so I was being obnoxious. Todd picked up the conversation again. How about this? You've seen how many of these cases? Mostly they're adults and mostly they're terrible actors. So it's not surprising that you find a kid like this, an African-American girl in a low-income apartment complex, and it's a bit shocking. That's the trick, though. She's using your expectations against you, using those internal biases to put you off your game.
I wasn't off my game. I didn't mean it that way, but I do think you're being played. The whole thing was too good to be true. It wouldn't surprise me if Janice was at one of your classes, maybe sat in and took a shit ton of notes. Ashanique hit all the boxes, avoided all the traps. She's good. Really good.
Matilda pulled a tea tree oil stick from her purse and rubbed some into her temples. The cooling effect was an instantly relaxing distraction.
That stuff stinks. The girl said, night doctors, right? That was weird.
She did. It was weird for someone her age. You seemed taken aback by it.
I did?
Yeah, you did.
Why?
I've heard it before. An old client. Fill me in, Maddie. I don't know what night doctors are.
I don't know that much, honestly, Matilda began. But they were pretty much boogeymen from the South.
1800 legends. Mostly forgotten today. At the time, they were as bad as anything. There were stories going around African-American communities that if you were out late or wandered into a part of town you weren't supposed to be in, the night doctors would get you. They'd perform hideous experiments, cut you up, and then use your body to train medical students.
Damn.
Most of those stories were actually spread by the Klan, trying to keep the black communities living in fear. But the truth is, a lot of African Americans ended up on the autopsy slabs of medical schools. Medicine was taking off. The days of the field surgeon were in the rearview mirror. They needed bodies to train on.
Shit. You're saying the stories were true?
There was a huge jump in grave robbery around the time the night doctor stories were spreading out across the South. I'm saying it's not a big leap to suggest that sometimes being dead wasn't a requirement. We're talking about a culture that saw black as less than human.
Todd mulled that over as the Volvo hit the exit ramp.
Okay, he said. So, maybe the folklore continued to today, in some communities. But you're not actually suggesting that Ashanique believes there are physicians in scrubs and masks stalking the streets, looking for people to dissect? Like roving gangs of killer doctors.
I'm not suggesting anything.
14. 8:36 p.m., November 13, 2018, University of Chicago, Chicago, Illinois. As soon as she got back to the office, Matilda searched her archives.
I know I've heard it before. It's here somewhere.
There was nothing on her walls about the night doctors, at least nothing out in the open. Matilda spent a few chaotic minutes combing through her file drawers. Despite the number of folders she'd stuffed into each one, they were all labeled and correctly organized. Matilda had a rule she'd learned from Clark: never touch something more than once. It was basically a riff on the old stitch-in-time chestnut.
but she saw the logic in it. With so many ongoing projects, she didn't have time to waste relabeling files or sorting papers. But there was no file about the night doctors.
It'll be on your computer, Maddie.
Oh, great. The computer. The department IT guy, a bearded dude with a nose ring, sighed loudly the last time he had been called in to install more RAM on Matilda's desktop. She actually had to get special approval from the department for the procedure. Rather than just upgrade her computer, they decided to keep adding RAM until they couldn't. When the IT guy had finished, he awkwardly mentioned one of the department's upcoming classes on reducing digital clutter.
"You know, to streamline your machine," he said, and added, "you have a ton, like a real ton of stuff on here. Cleaning it up would make it function better. Move fast. It's almost kind of a hazard."
Then he looked up at the office walls. Matilda told him she was happy with the speed of the machine, thank you. The IT guy left with another sigh. Matilda's voicemail was an example of the clutter that had him so concerned. She had 223 folders of voice messages. Each one was labeled with a date. They were downloaded automatically from the messaging system into her email inbox. Matilda didn't save every voice message she received. That would be crazy. No, instead, she deconstructed approximately 75% of them. Deconstruction, her own term, consisted of pulling important information from the message, typing it out, and then saving it as a text file before tossing the message itself. Running a search, she found the voice message she was looking for in a folder named TV, number 2449-293. The message, kept whole rather than being deconstructed, had been left for her approximately 16 months ago, around 11 on a Tuesday night. It was labeled TV 8-211. Matilda had listened to the message the following morning and returned the call, but she got no answer. She found out why a few days later. Matilda got up, closed the door to her office, and put on headphones. Plugging them into her desktop, she leaned back in her chair and listened to the wounded voice of a ghost. Hearing Vang again was unnerving and deeply painful.
"Hi, Dr. Deacon, it's me. I know I said I wouldn't call again for a while, but kind of cliche to say, but things are getting worse again. I know I started smoking again and, well, no surprise here, but I got sick. Went into the hospital and, you got that, right? I mean, they sent over those medical records. They should have. Anyway, that was bad enough. But what made it worse was the fact that they had me in a psych hold. I was really, really out of it. Like, real bad. I couldn't talk, so they didn't know about the fact that I had a head injury when I was a kid. I wish I could have at least told them that. It explains why I can't remember worth shit. Being in the hospital and being off the drugs, the memories just came barreling on back. Total knockdown, like being hit by a tsunami. They must have thought I was totally insane, hearing me howling and shit. It was bad, Doc. The usual ones came back. I had the memories about being on a fishing boat. That's actually a calming one. He had 6 children by 2 different women, which is kind of nuts, but... So, I also had the one about the Native American woman who got attacked by wolves. Memories like that are exactly why I smoke, you know? Shit. I keep calling them memories, and I'm sure you're shaking your head listening to this. They're not memories, okay? Visions is what I need to call them. I'll get there, Doc. Serious, I will. Anyway, I'm calling 'cause I seriously need your help.
I had this moment of enlightenment. I don't know what triggered it. Maybe it was something I heard or something I saw, but I honestly think it's a real memory from my childhood, Doc. Like from before the accident or whatever damaged me. And it's really fucked up. I don't know who else to tell about it. So, sorry, I'm putting it on you. Don't listen to this before you go to bed, okay? It's like the...
The voice recording was cut short. Matilda assumed Fang had been cut off by the messaging system, but she didn't actually know how long a message someone could leave. Regardless, he called back about 2 minutes later and left a second message. In her files, it was titled TV 8-212. Matilda pressed play and closed her eyes, readying herself for the shock to come.
Got cut off there. Not sure where I stopped, but, I was saying that this memory is for me. Like, the actual me. Only as a kid. A little kid. Before the foster homes and shit. I'm this little scruffy Hmong kid running around the streets of... Damn. I don't actually know what town, but it's maybe Mexico or Puerto Rico. Words are in Spanish. There are palm trees and beaches. I don't know what I'm up to, but it's clear that I've got no one. Ha. That shit didn't change much, did it? I'm totally a street kid. An urchin or whatever. Living with a bunch of other street kids. Stealing things and begging for change. That's me. And I'm maybe like 6 years old. This is in the 70s. It feels like the 70s. I see really old cars and people wear super lame clothes. I'm running around these streets when I get hit by a fucking car. Some asshole totally hits me. I'm not that messed up by the accident. I don't have anything more than some scrapes and some nasty bruises, but this car just totally drives off. Asshole. That's not even the part I was warning you about, Doc. It's what comes after that. Most people, they get run over somewhere, especially a little kid, and the police show up. Sure enough, a crowd gathers around me. Then an ambulance comes. This nasty old ambulance. I'm actually psyched 'cause going to the hospital means getting a bed to sleep in, and I've been sleeping on the streets up until this point, and it means getting an actual bona fide hot meal. The thing is, I don't go to the hospital. The ambulance takes some really funky turns and winds up outside the city. I'm strapped down in the back, but I get one arm free and sit up enough to see that we're in the countryside. Farms and everything on either side of the road. But it isn't until we pull off the street and into the driveway of this little house that I really start getting scared. And there's just this one phrase that's rattling around in my head. Night doctors. Beware of the night doctors.
Matilda opened her eyes and stopped the message for a moment. Just hearing those two words again was startling.
God damn it, Dr. Deacon. Why weren't you paying attention?
Matilda actually had done some reading about the night doctors after she first heard the message. But she was convinced Theo Vang suffered from paranoid delusions and schizoaffective personality disorder. It didn't help that he'd had some serious head trauma as a kid and was addicted to methamphetamine. Theo was a very, very damaged man, and no one would have blamed Matilda for dismissing his memories. She had tried to help him, but his concerns were simply too unbelievable to take seriously. Of course, hearing his voice again, she regretted her judgment. Matilda pressed play and braced for the rest of the message.
I know it when they wheel me into the house. There's a surgery-looking setup in there. A white room, all clinical like a lab or something. And, crazy as it seems, there's a big machine there. It looks like a telescope. Only the ceiling isn't open to see the stars.
It's crammed in there and wires and cables and things are lying all over the floors. They wheel me on this gurney, or whatever, and they strap down my one free arm. And there are other kids there. Other ones they took. Shit. This is hard to talk about without... Anyway, it's scary as hell. And I start screaming because I know that the night doctors won't heal me. They're gonna hurt me. And then, they do.
Matilda stopped the message and took off her headphones. As she did, her gaze fell on a printout half covered by post-it notes on the wall, just over the computer. She knew what it was, but needed to see it nonetheless. Matilda needed to have that moment, to feel those emotions. She needed the tears that would follow. The printout was an obituary from the Chicago Sun-Times. On it was a photo of a haunted-looking 50-something Hmong man. His name was Theo Vang, and he had jumped off the roof of his halfway house 5 hours after leaving Matilda the voice messages. 15. 7:48 p.m., November 13, 2018, Castleton, Indianapolis, Indiana. Dirk Bogrid woke up screaming. He was still at work, sitting behind the front desk at Sargent International Bank. He hadn't realized he'd fallen asleep. It looked bad. The security guard bolting upright at his post, sweating, heart racing. Unfortunately, he wasn't alone in the lobby. A woman walking past stopped and glanced over at him, concerned.
"I'm okay," Dirk said. Just the chair slipped is all.
As the woman exited the building through the revolving door, Dirk caught a distorted reflection of himself in the window, opposite his desk. He was ashen. Blinking several times to pull himself together, he leaned down and opened the Velcro top of his lunch bag to remove a silver pill case. Dirk shook 2 yellow and white Metrochime capsules out. He chewed them quickly, before washing them down with a sip of cold coffee.
"God damn," he said out loud to no one. "You're falling apart."
Dirk had been a security guard at Sargent International for 15 months, and he'd never fallen asleep on the job before. Not once. Even with his sleep patterns and the crushing boredom of his job, he'd always maintained a professional attitude. He certainly couldn't afford to lose another job. Not with his wife going down in her hours at the clinic and his son hoping to go to camp again.
"Pull it together, Dirk. You've got a lot of people depending on you."
An hour later, shift over, and no additional embarrassments. Dirk was ready to leave. A phone buzzed in his backpack as he packed up. Dirk was startled. He kept his cell in a case on his belt. The buzzing, however, was from the flip phone he'd gotten in the mail 2 months earlier, the one that had never rung once. Looking around and seeing no one nearby, Dirk pulled the flip phone from his bag. There was an encrypted message written out in a substitution cipher on the small screen. With the package had been a letter from Dr. Song. Written to resemble a friendly sales pitch, there were hidden messages embedded in the letter. It took Dirk an afternoon to decipher it, using the key his brother had given him. The long and short of it was simple. He needed to keep the flip phone with him at all times. If it rang, answer. If a text came through, read it.
"So it begins," Dirk thought. "Here we go, bro."
Dirk unfolded a scrap of paper from his wallet. It was a grid with letters in tiny boxes, all done in microscopic font. He laid it flat on the desk and slowly, methodically, decoded the text message from the flip phone. 51's daughter is null. Chicago. Marcy Lansing. 9:15. They need a path to Dr. Song. Send Childers to meet them at the museum in 2 nights.
So, this is spycraft, huh?
Using the flip phone, Dirk texted the decoded message to the only number in the phone's contacts. A Chicago-based number, but one he wasn't familiar with. As soon as it went, Dirk followed the directions he'd been given and snapped the cell phone in half. He tossed it
and the handwritten decoded message into the lockbox under his desk. They'd both be industrial shredded in the morning. Simple. Dirk leaned back in his chair and nodded to himself. The process was certainly easier than he'd expected. He had to admire the organization's commitment to secrecy and protocol. He figured you couldn't be too careful in today's screwed-up world. Dirk wasn't sure if he'd ever get another flip phone in the mail, but if he did, at least he knew how the whole thing worked. Easy enough. Dirk grabbed his things and tossed his keys to Billingham as the guard walked in, the zipper on his pants down. Billingham was an old guy, maybe in his late 60s, and Dirk didn't give him any grief. Reminded him of his father in a way. Always late and never really pulled together. On his way to his Passat, Dirk got a text from his wife, Beth.
Dinner's going to be a little earlier tonight, okay? Your friend Jeremy stopped by, said he was in town on short notice.
As he drove home, Dirk thought about the message some more.
Jesus, he thought. Jeremy, I haven't seen that old bastard in years. What the hell would bring him to Indianapolis?
Must be garbage with his wife again.
Dude could never keep it in his pants.
Dirk laughed out loud about that. For the 20 minutes that remained of his ride, he didn't yell at slow cars or honk his way into the exit lane. For the first time in what felt like years, he was actually excited to entertain at home. He just hoped Beth had cleaned the place up, at least a little. But when Dirk stepped into his suburban ranch home, his face dropped. Beth had tears running down her cheeks. Hunter was scared pale. And the man in the hoodie at the dinner table, sitting between his wife and teenage son, wasn't Jeremy. Dirk had never seen this man before. Not at work, not at the gym.
As Dirk walked across the room, carefully dropping his coat on the couch, he studied the man's face and became instantly incensed. What the fuck is this? Some guy got the wrong house?
He was ready to lay into the guy when he noticed two things. First, the man at the table with his family was totally bald. He didn't even have eyebrows. He was tall and thin, maybe in his mid-40s, but odd-looking for sure. And two, there was a small, clear box sitting on the hutch behind the table. The box was vibrating, making the sound an old dot matrix printer made.
Just who the hell are you?
Dirk asked.
Beth looked up at Dirk. Her eyes trembled in their sockets.
If this fucking guy has touched her?
The man at the table stood up.
He wore latex gloves like the kind you see at the hospital and held a gun. Dirk was no expert, but he guessed it was a Sig Sauer.
Sit,
the man said.
Dirk sat, panic breaking out the sweat on his forehead.
Where is 51? The man asked. Dirk shook his head. He didn't understand just what the hell that was supposed to even mean. He looked over at Beth. She was so pale, so frightened. And Hunter, the poor kid, was audibly grinding his teeth. Dirk knew he needed to put a stop to whatever was happening. Clearly the guy in the hoodie was there to rob them, or worse. Thinking back through his security guard training, the conflict resolution lectures and crisis management slideshows, Dirk quickly formulated a plan of attack. But the clear box sitting on the hutch interrupted his thoughts and timing. It dinged loudly, the way a convection oven would. Where is 51?
I don't know what you're talking about, man, Dirk said. Seriously, I don't know who 51 is, and I don't know who you are. I'm asking you nicely. Please get out of my house right now and leave my family alone.
The man in the hoodie turned and fired. A bullet whizzed just over Dirk's right shoulder before embedding itself in the wall behind him. A fine plume of drywall dust wafted past Dirk as he reflectively shuddered. I'm going to ask one more time. Where is 51? Dirk swallowed hard.
I honestly don't know. I'm telling you the truth.
As Dirk spoke, the man reached back to the clear box and opened its lid. The box was a 3D printer, an advanced model, not on the public market yet. He reached inside and pulled out two freshly printed rubber gloves. The man in the hoodie held the gloves up to the dining room light. Dirk could see fingerprints on the tips.
"I've been directed to keep things clean," the man said.
"So, you're going to be killing your family tonight.
I took your prints off the tumblers in the kitchen and had them printed on these gloves."
The man pulled the printed gloves over his medical exam gloves. Dirk pushed back from the table as fast as he could. He was going to take this motherfucker right here regardless of the cost. He figured that if he could dodge the man's first shot, he could get a hold of the gun, maybe wrestle it out of his hands.
"We'll see who's the real badass then."
But Dirk was slow. Before he'd moved a foot, the man in the hoodie turned. The gun barked, and blood Rorschached across Hunter's chest. The teenager gasped and fell backward. Beth screamed like she would scream forever. The man shot her in the neck, and blood drizzled the table as she tumbled backward to the floor. Dirk couldn't even move, could hardly breathe. Calm as ever, as though he did this sort of thing on any given evening, the man in the hoodie pulled a cell phone from his back pocket and placed it on the table in front of Dirk.
"I need you to enter the phone number you sent a text to tonight," the man said. "You remember, don't you? You used a shitty flip phone."
I don't think I can."
Dirk couldn't help but stare down in horror at the bodies of his wife and son. It had all happened so quickly, he wasn't even sure of what he was seeing.
"Those are just dummies," he told himself. "Beth and Hunter went out for dinner. I'm just dreaming."
The man in the hoodie snapped his fingers to get Dirk's attention. Dirk was crying uncontrollably, tears dripping all over his shirt as he picked up the cell phone and, hands shaking, typed in the number as he remembered it. Dirk handed the cell to the man in the hoodie.
"This is correct?"
"Aye."
The man leaned forward and pressed the Sig Sauer to Dirk's temple. Dirk planned to close his eyes, but once again, he was too slow. The gun kicked, the bullet burrowed through Dirk's brain, singeing the cerebral cortex as it traveled and exited the other side of his head, enshrouded in a fine mist of blood. Dirk's body slumped onto the table.
"How's that for clean?"
Raid asked the corpses. He was packing up the 3D printer when a sudden, urgent pounding on the front door caught his attention. Raid stopped what he was doing and slowly opened the front door to see a middle-aged Indian woman standing on the porch in a sari. She looked quite concerned, frantic even.
"I'm sorry. I live next door and heard. Is Mr. Bograd here?"
Raid opened the door and the neighbor stepped inside. She was shaking, her eyes darting. As soon as she saw the bodies, the Indian woman's face began to curl into a mask of horror. Raid shot her in the face before she could scream. The Indian woman stumbled forward and collapsed, face down.
Shit.
Now Raid had a problem. Dirk couldn't very well have shot and killed the neighbor because, as an autopsy would determine, he was dead before she arrived. Raid picked up a leather briefcase he left by the front door and opened it. He removed a pair of stainless steel surgical-grade forceps and carefully dug the bullet out of the Indian neighbor's head. Luckily, her skull had fractured, and the bullet was relatively easy to find in the resulting mess. Raid walked over to the dining room table and carefully pried the bullet from the wall where Dirk had been sitting. Raid switched the two bullets. The scene was set. The Indian neighbor heard the shots. She ran over, and then Dirk, depressed, angry, broken, shot her before he shot himself.
Good enough.
Satisfied, Raid left.